Welcome to the Alpha One edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the Alpha One antitrypsin deficiency community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, senior correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're in Washington, D.C. at the 2025 meeting of the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases, and our guest is Dr. Alexander Kalb, a Danish hepatologist with Denmark's Odense University Hospital. Among other things, Dr. Kalb treats patients with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, AATD. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
This is, of course, a rare disease. It's got a liver component, it's got a lung component. As you said, it's a fascinating disease, and yet something like, I believe, only 6% of patients have been properly diagnosed.
Yeah, that's correct. This is a genetic disease, and you need two genes to have the clinical disease, and then, of course, also you can be a carrier. And the trick or the challenge with this disease is that in many, and particularly those that develop the liver phenotype, they don't really have any symptoms. So they largely go undetected. But there's also an issue that even though you have symptomatic liver disease, symptomatic lung disease, why you should, in essence, always check for this, it's not happening. So we are actually facing that many different data, but maybe 95% go undetected. And that's, of course, not acceptable. And that was part of what we're discussing today. How can we change that? And actually, it's not so difficult.
Why do you think that is, that so many patients go undetected with this particular disorder?
There are different factors. One, of course, is it's asymptomatic at the beginning. And there's also a change in the habits of the doctors. Traditionally, this has been perceived a little bit as a pediatric disease because people who have this genotype with the two alleles develop something in when they're children. And then we say largely not so much at adults, but that we're changing, learning now that this is actually becoming a very significant factor, and many people end with liver transplant. So there's something about the awareness of doctors, our understanding that has expanded very much in the last years, but also now we're seeing serious drug developments. Because sometimes you say, okay, finding a disease, but what should we do? How can we do meaningful thing here? And that's what's changing. So the whole landscape around it is changing.
Okay, so in your presentation, you mentioned that 26% of patients with AATD report advanced liver fibrosis, and 15% of adults with AATD-related liver disease require a transplant.
Yeah, so that underscores that for these people, this is really serious. And that's also why we should take it serious and really bridge it to what we can do. So actually, there's been for a while a lot of things we can do, even though at least for the liver phenotype, drugs are still in testing. You have something for the lung phenotype. But understanding this, detecting it early, because then you can also detect the families, because it's a genetic disease. Right. So you're not just doing the patient itself, but the whole family you risk. And for instance, for the lung phenotype, if you're a smoker, that's really disastrous. So if you know that this is really advancing your lung disease very, very fast, but also the interaction. So this is one thing that caused damage to the liver, but a lot of things also very pronounced in our society. For instance, obesity or alcohol consumption. And these things harm the liver synergistically. You can have a good conversation with the patients around that.
Okay, so we're talking about a lot of lifestyle factors here. Smoking, obesity, drinking.
All of them.
All of them. Is any one of them worse than the others?
The one with the data we have, we can see that sort of multiplies the liver-related risk is in particular alcohol. Obesity also, and of course smoking also, many don't know that, also reinforces liver disease. But here is particularly the lung. So this disease is actually both in the liver and in the lung. And I don't know if I can tell you the story because it's actually a beautiful way of understanding how the organs in the body work together. So the liver is producing a protein. That's a protein that then goes to the lung and protects the lung against harm. The problem is then this protein cannot get out of the liver. So it's actually they cannot get out and protect the lung, and therefore the lungs are harmed.
And that's why in the case of the liver, it's a gain of function.
Exactly.
And in the lung, it's a loss of function.
Exactly, yes.
So in a way, it's the worst of both worlds here.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, isn't it also true that alpha-1 occurs in pockets Like there's somewhat of a founder effect. It occurs in families and geographic regions.
Exactly. We know that the genotype in Europe is probably almost twice as frequent as in the United States, for instance, more northern than southern Europe. In northern Europe, we've got quite a lot of these people living with the genes, and also those who've got both alleles, which are the high risk groups. So that's partly also of my interest, because it's really of relevance in my part of the world.
Could it possibly be related in the way that multiple sclerosis is, we know that it occurs more commonly in latitudes north of 40 degrees?
And maybe if you look at various genetic diseases, of course, they cluster a little bit. Another one, I'm not so familiar with the genetics of this, but if you look at hemochromatosis, the genetic disease that sucks up iron and intoxicate our body with iron. That is very much in the Nordic, also in Northern Europe.
Is that similar to Wilson disease?
No, Wilson disease is the one that sucks up copper. So that's a very rare one, but actually hemochromatosis, also part of the rare disease spectrum, is the one that sucks up iron. And it's very, very good to have iron, either in the liver, nor the heart, nor the pancreas. Then you'd have heart disease, liver disease.
But you can't have too much.
Yes, you can have too much, because you need a little bit of iron, otherwise you cannot attract oxygen from the air. But if you have too much, it's toxic for the organs.
And so in the same way you're saying about alpha-1?
Yes, there it's that it's too much in the liver, in the liver cells, cannot get out. It's full with them. It's beautiful if you look at it, histology. But of course, it's harmful. It's just like have a cell and it's full of garbage, because these are misfolded. So they cannot really get out. So they harm the liver and then the lung that needs protection. Because in the blood, there's a lot of proteases. They cut down things we don't need. But the problem is they also cut down the lung, if you don't protect it. So the liver is actually helping the lungs to protect again these proteases by removing them. But and when that doesn't happen, then you have this accelerated or, let's say, slowly declining lung function. If you add tobacco to it, it goes much faster.
So I understand that liver transplant is really the only sure thing that can cure a patient. Is that correct? But not everybody can get a liver transplant.
Exactly. That's part of the whole conundrum in liver. Say, okay, we got the perfect treatment. A new liver, wow, that's wonderful. But it's not so wonderful. Of course, you need a liver. It's a very expensive treatment. It's not an easy treatment. You need many different drugs afterwards associated with various different risks.
To prevent your body from rejecting it.
Yes, exactly. These are associated with risks for kidneys, for cancer, many different things you need to be really out on top of.
Right.
So we cannot transplant our way out. So the deal is basically to try to catch disease in earlier state, prevent them from progressing to this symptomatic disease with need of transplant. And I think that's the whole journey you ask. So go as early as possible and try to what can be modified, and those there we already have some treatment to protect the lungs so people basically can live longer, function and thrive better.
The potential for therapy, what's in the pipeline, what's out there? For example, Takeda, we know, is working pretty hard on this.
Yes.
Can you give us an idea of the landscape of a pipeline for potential therapies?
Yeah, there are therapies that targets the liver, there are therapies that targets the lung, and something that targets both. So what is characteristic with the therapies we're seeing now coming out? Traditionally, what's happening, and still we lose a standard for the lung, is basically just supplying. Okay, they don't have antitrypsin in the blood, they get some antitrypsin from other people. That's sort of a substitution augmentation therapy, we call. But then if you look at the disease mechanism, this is a gene, so you need to go to the genes. So there are different ways you can basically manage the genes. You could do it at the DNA level, you can do it at the RNA level. RNA is sort of the transcript of, and then you can do it with the transcripts there.
Are you speaking of the potential for gene therapy here?
Yes, it is potential for gene therapy. Still, I think the world is more mature, and that's also why I see companies like Takeda is advanced with fazirsiran. We have a phase three trial running on fazirsiran, which is an siRNA. When this is transcribed in the liver, this sort of blocks the RNA, so it's not you don't have the protein synthesis. So that protects the liver from having a lot of this accumulating in the cells. These cells are full of something they don't need. In the end, they die. And that will create inflammation and in the end leads to scarring of the liver. And scarring is fibrosis or cirrhosis or what we call the clinical liver disease.
Now, we know that gene therapy is extremely expensive. The few gene therapies that have one FDA approval are anywhere from $2, $3, or even $4 million.
Yeah, this is not a gene therapy. This is at the silencing RNA. So basically, you have not the gene itself, the DNA, it's transcribed RNA, you sort of silence.
Okay, because so I'm aware of one hemophilia gene therapy that's upwards of $4.5 million.
Yeah, yeah, that's again the issue with some of these drugs that are developed for rare disease, for it being attractive for drug development coming in, of course, selling it to a relatively small fraction, they often end up very expensive. But again, it's, I don't know where it is, but it's important we get some of this out and test it, and the more companies that go into it, the better. Because then you have competition, you try different things. And again, out there, back to the patients, it's all about the patient, the real people out there. We had a video in our meeting here, Lorinda, who told her story. And again, about a late disease, several doctors, many years of delay, a lot of frustration, very sad, ending up with a liver transplant. But it's even worse than that, her diagnosis of alpha-1 antitrypsin-related liver disease.
After
the liver transplant. After they got it out. That should have been 20 years before. So I think that's really a learning case.
That's unusual, though,
isn't it?
That's
unusual because we can detect it relatively easy, because you can measure the alpha-1 antitrypsin in the blood. It's very cheap. It's very easy.
Right.
Then you could capture it. And then after you do that, if it's low, then you do the the gene test.
So they could have known years and years earlier before she went through all of that, what she had.
Yes, and she had different indication for that. She has got lung issues. That would, you see, in every people would have lung issues. That could be asthma or chronic osteopulmonary disease or elevated liver function. Says they should be tested because it's an easy thing. It's a cheap thing, and the important and the information you get is important.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I just think we need to acknowledge or enjoy that this field is moving forward. Something is happening. You know, there are hundreds of people in this room. There are 500 people online. That would not have happened 5 years or 10 years ago. So there's enthusiasm. There's belief in this field. So I'm optimistic and happy on behalf of my patients, basically, that there's a future for them.
On that note, we will wrap up. We've been talking to Dr. Alexander Kahl, who's a Danish hepatologist with Denmark's Odense University Hospital. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.